This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Florida Spectacular. We are full on in the summer preheating part of Florida. We are taping this the end of May. It will air the first week of June. How are you holding up in your little landlocked attic, Rick?
Oh, it's good. We're kind of in our summer pattern where you know, it gets cloudy every afternoon, you know, about quitting time, and then it rains or it doesn't, but it's like 50-50. And so it seems weather-wise, at least we're in full-on summer.
Preheating, remember? We're just preheating.
Sick. But I was up in Gainesville this weekend. And
again?
My mom's moving, so there's going to be a lot of that. And they're not getting the rain. And it's been that way for several years. And it's, you know, it feels a lot hotter up there because they're not getting the rain. So weather continues to be a thing here in Florida.
Weather's a thing. Weather's a glorious thing. I just got back from a couple of weeks in the Keys, and I don't want to be inside at all. But see, I like the heat. But to me, when I lived in Orlando, the worst part of the heat was that there was no sea breeze.
Yeah.
Which makes it really a little different. I live on the Gulf Coast, and our guest today lives on the Atlantic Coast. Judging by the subject of his book, and also now that I look at the back cover, the bio on his book confirms that our guest, Dan Ryder, is a Cocoa Beach guy. And welcome, Dan. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, that's one of the more interesting things about the weather in Florida, because it takes on so many different faces. You have the subtropical and the subtropical. And then here on the barrier island, the rain is completely different. You see it out west when you look to the horizon. It's building over the wetlands. But at this time of year especially, it does break up a lot over the river, rather, the Banana River. So like it's coming west and then it just breaks up and it goes through the barrier island in pockets or little, streams of rain.
Most of our weather on the Gulf Coast in the summer, the rain comes from the southeast, because I'm on the other side of the state, and you can watch it, because I used to have a part-time job at an airport. I worked ground crew for banner towing planes, and the airport in St. Pete is right on Tampa Bay, and I could be out in the field, and I could watch the rain coming from the southeast. You could see the wall of rain, and that's one of my favorite things about Florida.
You have a good scope, like the flatness of Florida and the width and the breadth of the horizons allows you, especially when you're looking out over water, to see, you know, such amazing large swaths of nature moving. So it's pretty interesting.
I find it amazing. I want to talk about your book, because I'm going to be very honest. I was not expecting quite what I got. I do not know how to surf, and that's okay. I was a kayak guide. I paddleboard, all that stuff. And I wasn't sure what I was going to get when I said, yeah, I want to read the book. And it's delightful. Like, it's a lot of fun. You're very, you make me want to surf. But your book, by the way, for the people listening who are not in our private party, is called On a Rising Swell, Surf Stories from Florida's Space Coast. And, you know, I think part of it, no disrespect to all three of us have the same publisher. So much of what gets floated by me from this particular publisher is academic or quasi-academic. And you've written for surf magazines, right?
Yeah, I definitely tend towards more general audience as far as my style of writing. I think that UPF does allow one or two of these to slip through the cracks every year, which is really a testament.
It's to their credit.
Yeah. And Sean Hunter, who was the acquisitions editor, took a chance. You know, this is a book that's being published under the guise of an academic press, but really it's a different kind of book, like you say.
Yeah, you're in their trade. Actually, I think Rick and I both are in their trade division.
Yeah.
We all forgot to get our PhDs, which is just fine.
is that how we got there? Okay.
Yeah. So, but I think, you know, you're right in the beginning first. You kind of had me with the sentence, 20 years of brine, of salt marinade, of inhaling the sea's musks have permanently transformed me. I mean, that was just beautiful. So we don't have time to go chapter by chapter, and we want people to buy the book and read the book. So I know what I'm fascinated by, but what's your favorite essay?
Well, okay. So, and also I've been listening to your podcast, so I do, I think we can talk more about some of the historical stuff that's in the book, which is, you know, the surf stuff is interesting, but it's only one facet of the book. So I think we can talk a lot about the historical stuff. As far as my favorite essay, I'm always going to say it's the last one I wrote, which is the last one in the book. It's called Openings. And, but I'm always biased to that, more recent stuff. So yeah, that's the reason it's my favorite. It's the freshest, you know, and it's a very technical, surfy one though. Yeah. It's taking on a different mode. It's more like a sports writing mode. Like, you'd have like Norman Mailer writing about Muhammad Ali or Roger Federer writing. I mean, David Foster Wallace's essays on Roger Federer, that kind of stuff where you're just from a spectator's vantage. Again, it doesn't even take place in Florida, the majority of that chapter, whereas the rest of the book is very Florida centric. I'd say it's bookended by San Francisco and Hawaii, but 25 out of 27 chapters take place right on the Barrier Island, between Cape Canaveral and Sebastian Inlet, the 45 mile Barrier Island where surf champions rose up to the tune of, you know, three world champions out of a population of 54,000 people, which is more or less the population of Goose Creek, South Carolina, or Tinley Park, Illinois. it's basically a feat that's unmatched in modern sports history, the fact that we could get such talent that comes out of here in one sport. But so the openings chapter I thought was pretty exciting. It went into, you can't talk about surfing in Florida or surfing on the planet if you don't talk about Kelly Slater, who's widely regarded as the best surfer of all time, but at least best competitive surfer of all time. Kelly Slater is a guy, by the way, for people who don't know.
Isn't there a statue of him behind the Ron John in Cocoa?
Yeah, it's not behind the Ron John. It's at where the streets split, 4th Street North, which is the beginning of the fabled streets of Slater's childhood. It was put up in 2010. There's a small essay in the book about the erection of the statue and the ceremony. But yeah, it's a bronze statue, really well done by Tasha Drazich, a local artist and friend of the Slaters. And it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool to have a living legend, you know, from a hometown of 11,000 people, you know, and whenever he comes in town, it's an event and everybody knows him. So writing about Kelly was pretty fun. If I had to look back and without the recency bias, at which chapter I like the best and which chapter I think most people sort of connect with, it's a small chapter in the middle, which is has the memoir feel to it. It's called The Birth of Style, and it's about where and I really learned how to become proficient at surfing together in Cocoa Beach on these sort of soul sessions out there just when no one else was out. And I think it really talks to the devotional aspect, the obsessional aspect of surfing, and particularly surfing in Florida, which is requires a bit of an ability to accept that you're not going to be getting great waves all the time, a willingness to be able to have an alternating regimen of zen-like patience and split-second receptiveness to when the wind shifts or the waves start to cooperate. And I think it makes you appreciate more surfing in a place like Florida, where you don't have world-class waves, but you have steady waves and warm water, beach access. It's a great place for beginners, for children to learn how to surf, which is why it became a nursery, I think, for so many ultra-competitive and world champion surfers.
Tell our listeners about the first time you were on a surfboard.
First time I was on a surfboard is in the book. It's called First Wave, Ocean Beach, San Francisco. And Ocean Beach, San Francisco is one of the heaviest, most gnarly cold water spots in Northern California. It's not a place to learn how to surf. I did not know that. I just knew that it was a cozy place to where I was living at the time, which was I was living with some, sharing a room with some guys in the Panhandle in San Francisco. And a friend of mine just decided, hey, let's go. It's something to do. I was in my early 20s. Most of the people who become really good surfers or who become surf writers, at least, learned how to surf as a child. You know, I'm a Floridian. I grew up in Plantation. I moved there when I was three. I was born in Montreal. My family immigrated to Plantation, Florida, which is just west of Fort Lauderdale. It was on the fringe of the Everglades there at the time, mm-hmm. before they cut out Weston and who knows what else they're cutting out. And that's the reason why we're not getting the rains, too, by the way. I think it's because of the, you know, the less wetlands.
Somebody asked me about that last week. Like, how come we don't get our reliable summer storms every afternoon? And I said, well, I'm not a scientist, but I think some of it has to do with the fact that the transpiration and the evaporation rates are way down because we've paved so much.
Yeah.
And, you know, it changes the weather cycle, unfortunately.
Yeah. Look to the trade winds and see where they're blowing in at that time of in the afternoon and what they're blowing over. Because if they're blowing over untouched wetlands, it's going to clouds are going to form, you know, and if they're blowing over apartment buildings, you know, then you get left.
Yeah, we're lucky in Orlando because most of our storms this time of year come up the I-4, you know, kind of follow I-4, and the Green Swamp is right there. And they're trying to protect the Green Swamp as much as they can, but it continues to be developed and they keep trying to encroach on it. But we're still getting big thunder boomers, and I'm so grateful for that. Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. And Gainesville will get enough rain eventually, too.
I hope.
Yeah, it's not going to become a desert, I don't think.
Now, I saw a picture on Ryan Worthington is one of our supporters, and he posted pictures of the Suwannee on social media yesterday. And the Suwannee looks horrible right now. It's just, you know, he contrasted it with a picture of, you know, this kind of raging torrent of water coming out from a spring run with something, you know, taken this week that is completely dry. Mm. It's a kind of a thing. But anyways, you're telling us, I want to hear about your first time surfing in San Francisco. Because to me, you know, having seen the Pacific, it seems like such a crazy place to start, you know, surfing.
Well, okay. San Francisco, before we go to San Francisco, though, I would just on the same topic of the atmospheric changes, a lot of the book does also touch on the existential questions that a surfer as the sentinel of the shore is the first to see the changing of the sandbars and the sea level rise impacts and stuff has to ask himself or ask herself these existential questions of what it means to live on a bare island where the sand is ephemeral. And we go into some of the patterns from before. With the indigenous Ais people who lived here 4,000 years ago. They were contemporaries of the Egyptians, ancient Egyptians, who lived here for 150 generations, which is more than twice the Roman Empire, and who learned to be as fluid as the sands, which were shifting all the time, you know, which were basically retreating all the time because of sea level rise. Now it's accelerated so much that we're constantly have to do beach renourishment, which we just finished another round of here in Brevard County. But anyway, back to San Francisco. San Francisco, California also is dealing with these issues too. You know, San Onofre is a really famous breakdown near San Clemente, and their parking lot's getting washed out like it's never been 50 years before. You know, these things are happening everywhere. But at the time, I was 20 years old. It was or 21 or 22, and it was right around the turn of the century. And I went out to San Francisco trying to be like Kerouac or one of the Beats, and I found it had been just transformed to, you know, like a pincushion of heroin addicts and pit bulls and the rainbows trampled to dust and all this stuff. But anyway, we had a great time. We went out to Ocean Beach, nearly drowned ourselves. We rented 40-pound soft top kook boards, rented wetsuits, which is a disgusting thing to do if you consider
everybody pees in. What is it there's two types of people who pee in their wetsuit and people who lie about it.
Yeah. And so to rent one, obviously, and then so I was the basic definition of what you call a kook, a k-o-o-k, a kook. This is worse than a beginner. It's a dangerous beginner. It's someone who knows nothing and who gets in everyone else's way. But that day we had no chance of getting in anyone's way because we couldn't even make it out past the first break. It was double overhead, you know, pumping barrels, an ocean beach where professional surfers and crazy people go. But I was able to turn around and ride one little whitewater wave in. And at that moment, I knew that I was going to devote my life to surfing because the feeling that you get when you're, you know, in that transitional phase between water and wind and you're flying. And I don't know, it's just some people, it just touches them in a certain way where you need to keep seeking that out again. And it took me a while to really get into it. I learned to properly surf in LA that same summer. I moved down to LA and then I was called back to Florida. I was working in Tampa, but I had met someone out there in LA who told me that there actually were waves in Florida, which I grew up unaware, going to Fort Lauderdale Beach and Miami.
Not near Tampa.
Yeah. And I mean, on the Gulf Coast, very rarely. And then on the South Atlantic coast, the Bahamas block all the incoming swells. The swells are generated out to sea by storms or wind events that send them, you know, over the distances where they organize themselves and turn into rideable waves. And in South Florida, very infrequently, it would need to be a north swell, some sort of a nor'easter coming straight off the coast and shooting the waves at a southerly angle so that they could slide between Bahamas and the East Coast. But I didn't know there were waves until I came to Cocoa Beach and New Smyrna. I was driving across from I-4 and getting stuck at Fantasy of Flight for like 2 hours.
Yep. We know yep. the pain.
That hangs together. So let's go back. What were you doing in Tampa? I live west of Tampa, and I don't understand why anybody lives in Tampa, to be honest.
I came to join a construction site that we had. My grandfather was involved with some other people who were doing construction and needed help doing punch out and clean up on a construction site. And I figured I'd go and learn construction. So I went to Tampa. I learned how to do some construction stuff. And I ended up getting a general contractor license. So I've actually dealt with some of these issues with wetlands, and typically we wouldn't mitigate wetlands. You know, we would build around them and use them as, you know, an amenity because it's pretty nice to live near wetlands, you know? So there's natural uplands and natural wetlands. I learned about that in, you know, civil engineering and stuff. And really that's what I did for about 10 years, really hard, was doing construction. But for the last 5 years of that living, my construction work was in Tampa and Lakeland. But for the last 5 years, I ended up moving to Cocoa Beach and just driving over there instead of driving to surf. I would wake up at 4 a.m. and I would drive to the construction site to get there at 6, work all day, and then come back and hopefully surf in the afternoon or skip a day if I could, or just be ready on the weekends because the surfing was more important to me, even though I wasn't making money surfing. How I judged my success was how much I could go surfing, basically.
This is pretty much every surfer story ever that I've ever heard.
I mean, the thing that's different between surfing and being an alcoholic is it actually makes you healthy while you're surfing. But everything else is the same.
So you're a surfaholic is what you're saying.
Basically.
So yeah. how does the riding come in all this?
Oh, I actually consider myself a writer before I considered myself a surfer. I didn't start writing until my 20s, but this is like pre-San Francisco. I was between colleges and I actually went to Paris and I was studying at the Sorbonne for a year. I wanted to become a painter in the Impressionism style. And I figured if I learned how to do realism, I could then move towards Impressionism. And I brought a single canvas with me into the Montparnasse. It was of a picture I'd taken of the Sherry Netherlander clock and the hotel facade in New York City. And I figured I would get the lighting exactly perfect and I'd have one picture under my belt. And I worked for 3 months on the fluted base of the clock and I couldn't get the way the light was glinting off of it. And I just had to keep taking breaks and going to cafes and reading books to get my mind off of it. And a dangerous book, someone says, a dangerous book to read in Paris is A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway.
Yes.
Which I was reading at the Select. and the Closerie de Lilas and all these places, and figured, man, I'm just going to try this. And started writing little journal entries, little impressionist sketches of the way that the light hit the Seine, or how someone was moving her hand at a cafe as she picked up her coffee cup, or little snippets of dialogue. And I saw that I could be way more expressive this way than with paint. And basically gave up that. I still have that Sherry Netherlander clock half-finished painting, which I'm going to probably go back to one day. But ever since then, I've just been doing writing. Fiction is definitely my first love, which is interesting that my first book is nonfiction, because I was working all the time on short stories and getting them submitted to literary journals and having many, many rejections until I started getting acceptances, and have a good number of short stories, short fiction stories, non-surf related stuff published in literary journals, which really forced me to hone the craft and the technique required in you know, moving a reader along and being expressive in a way that was interesting. And the surf writing was almost like it came between. It was an accidental accumulation of work that I had been doing just on the side, which I guess started, there's a local free monthly rag in Cocoa Beach called the Beachside Resident, which for a while had a lot of sway with like the local community, and all the city commissioners read it, and all the people in the cafes read it, and all the condo owners read it. And somehow I was given a slot there to write 1200 words a month, whatever I wanted to write, anything, really anything, as long as it was not, you know, it was, you know, PG rated. And in those spaces, I started writing little surf themed essays and vignettes, sometimes little screeds against the spring breakers. I think one of the more popular pieces I wrote there was called The Field Guide to Spring Break Cocoa Beach. It was 2013. And it was a naturalist's guide to all the non-local species who flooded the barrier island during the spring break season. And I gave it all Latin names and classified them and could recognize them by their feather coloration or by the bags that they took from, or the Disney World memorabilia and things like this, and their activities.
This reminds me of your chapter in the book where you have the Surfer's Bible, passages from the Surfer's Bible.
Another Beachside Resident piece. Yeah. The passages from the Surfer's Bible.
Mm-hmm. You know, Exodus 7:17, the plagues, includes red tide. And I love that. And so many other dangers. Although hammerheads, are they really, I have to ask before we go too much farther. Hammerheads, are sharks really an issue for surfers?
Sharks are an issue. I'd say sharks are an issue for surfers in the same way that lightning is an issue for golfers. You know, it's about that's you know, that would be a good simile. You know, people who got hit by sharks, typically they're black tips or spinner sharks, but you probably know 2,000 surfers, and you know maybe two who got bitten and who basically have scars to prove it, but didn't get mauled or maimed or eaten or anything like that. So and if you're smart and you don't swim in pods of mullet and stay there when other fish are all around you, then you lower your chances. And if you're a longboarder and you can put your feet up on top of your board, then you lower your chances. And if you don't swim in like really murky water at night, then you lower your chances. So there's a lot of ways. I've probably surfed on average an hour or two a day for the past 22 years. I've seen them, no doubt. I've seen them many times, but it's not a concern. I don't think it's not something that you have to be super scared of around here.
If you've listened to certain episodes of my podcast, you know that I'm very pro shark. And so I'm happy to have somebody here to say something good about sharks. So, and you know, that's the thing you always hear about surfers. Oh, you know, they see people paddling out and they think that they're a seal and they eat them. And I've always wondered, like, do Florida sharks actually think about seals?
No. Great whites in San Francisco. I used to serve a place called Pacifica south of San Francisco. And it was getting closer to Stinson Beach, which is a great white breeding ground. And there were seals all the time in the lineup with you, out floating out there with you. Lots of seals. And yeah, I could see a great white thinking you were a seal, but nothing like that in Florida is happening ever.
Yeah, I do know one person who was bit by a shark, and I've met a person who was bit by an alligator. Never met anyone who was struck by lightning. That would be like the holy trio of
Yeah. But
see,
the catastrophes.
I know somebody who was struck by lightning, and I know somebody who was bit by an alligator, but I don't know, and I know somebody who was bit by a dolphin, but I don't know anybody who's been bitten by a shark.
Okay, this conversation is going way too floral.
What? It's they're all still alive.
This is so good.
Actually, the guy I know, I'd love to get the guy who's been bitten by an alligator on the podcast. He's a teacher, but his avocation is he scuba dives for fossils in Florida rivers.
Oh.
And he was on the Peace River and scubaing looking for, you know, like, I don't know, dolphin penis fossils or whatever you find out there. And he came across a gator and the gator attacked him. And the only reason he survived, you know, they do the death roll, is that he had a scuba gear. And he just started wailing on the gator till the gator tapped out and went, okay, I'm out.
Not worth it.
And he has nerve damage in, I think, one of his calves, but he still goes out there. I mean, he's like, you know, it's one of the chances you take.
Yeah, when you're out there.
So I, you know, sharks don't bother me. Great whites might bother me, but we don't have a lot of those here. So
yeah, they won't come to, you know, especially at Cocoa Beach. There's not going to be something that close to shore, you know. Anyway.
So where's your favorite place to surf in Florida?
I mean, when it's working out back in at the streets is the best, because you're just going to get a session by yourself, you know. And if the sandbars are always moving, they're very untrustworthy. It's difficult to get a good wind, but if all the stars align and you get a perfect session out in this somewhere in the streets are basically, there's the main downtown street of Cocoa Beach is called Minuteman Parkway, which leads to the high school. Everywhere south of that, until you get to the Space Force Base, the old Patrick Air Force Base, is basically the streets of Cocoa Beach. So anywhere in that range is going to be my favorite spot. It's not always the best. I do like surfing the jetty just south of the port on a north swell. It gets very clean and it curves out to sea so that a north wind actually becomes offshore there, whereas it's sideshore the rest of the way down. And the wind ideally should be blowing offshore to groom the waves, to make them smooth and clean and reliable. So that's, you know, an interesting spot, the jetty, because there's a sand salient that builds up there as well. The north to south, the flow of the sand is halted there. So it creates interesting sandbar formations. And also, of course, Cocoa Beach Pier is really nice, because it creates a similar salient, and it's sort of a hopping scene. That was the scene in the 60s. In the book, I go into the history of surfing also in Brevard County, where you have the golden age of the 60s, where Dick Ketry and Gary Proper and these legends like Murph the Surf, these characters inhabited this place and made it really what it is today. Ron John Surf Shop was out there at the end of the pier when it was an old school classic surf shop. Before it became Disneyfied. But I love Ron John. I trash on Ron John, but I love them. They support the local community. Even though they're hawking plastic tikis and things like that, they and pop out boards, they do support local surfers, and they always are, you know, there to you know, donate to local causes and stuff. So I really do like Ron John. And without Ron John, we wouldn't have the local stores either, because they really bring in the culture and the subculture, you know, and even the counterculture.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of lost something for me when they opened one. I grew up in Clearwater, and they opened one at the other end of 60 in Clearwater. I'm like, why? And I mean, there is a skate culture, definitely, but surfing in Pinellas County is not anything like the East Coast. I mean, I think the closest we get, and maybe you're familiar, have you been to Upham?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
And
that's
when it works there. There's some interesting setups which are actually better. But it's, you know, 3 or 4 days out of the year you're going to get really good waves. Whereas here we'll get 40 or 50 really good days, and we'll get 300 rideable days. Where you guys have very few rideable days.
Well, they also are doing the re-nourishment has been a problem, and you know, it changes everything as they re-nourish that beach. And have you been out there since the last storms?
No, I don't really go there too often. The only way that you can really catch a good swell on the Gulf Coast is if a storm is moving into the Gulf, and because the only way you have swell propagation is to have a massive wind, you know, far away from the coast, sending waves that way. That's which is really why they don't have waves. You know, I don't know about the way that they're changing the beaches out there. We've had a lot of problems with the beach renourishment in the past. In 2005, they dredged sand from the Canaveral shoals directly onto the beaches, as opposed to what they're doing now is they're dredging beach sand from north of the port, and they're bypassing the port and sending beach sand back onto the beach. What they were doing then was sending this really coarse, shelly, grainy sand onto the beach in 2005 after the 2004 Francis and Jean storms basically eroded all of the sand off of Cocoa Beach and Satellite Beach. So they sent this sand, which wasn't a good match for the natural sand, and it created washouts and basically like a 6-foot cliff that you'd have to jump down to get to the beach, and then a terrible trough in the near shore profile, which caused rip currents, drownings, and shut down all the waves for about 4 or 5 years. So that was a travesty. Luckily, we had some people here who were willing to call it out, and we worked with the local, with the mayor and the commission to make sure that the next time they dredged, they used proper sand. And I think they got a little bit better. But just the idea of pumping and dumping and trying to build up, maybe it'll buy you 10, 20, 30 years. But in reality, the way the AIS did it was they allowed the island to roll back landward. The barrier island is a buffer. The barrier island is supposed to be a movable buffer and migrates landward in periods of sea level rise to prevent the ocean from breaching the wetlands and the inland areas. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to barricade the entire east coast of Florida. It's impossible. It's impossible. There's going to be new inlets that are going to be cut, new washover fans into the lagoon, and eventually this stuff's going to happen, and it's a reality, and it's accelerating.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I learned this was basic college stuff. Like one of my college science classes, I remember the professor saying, "Look, on the west coast of Florida, this is the way that the barrier islands are supposed to migrate." But always that but. I feel like I'm the only person out there who thinks beach renourishment is awful other than surfers. Like I am so against beach renourishment, and I realize why that's a problem if we just stop doing it. But it's
right. You would have to implement managed retreat or something else.
Right.
You know? We hate that word in Florida. We hate that world as a culture in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's been wild over here since the hurricanes watching, and most of the barrier islands in Florida were close to 100% flooded. Like, I there are very few buildings I know of, 22 miles of beach, very few I know of that were not flooded, and people are fighting elevating. And I get it. It's expensive, and they've always lived there. Sometimes
you can get through to some of the people by going back to the good book. It reminds me of the parable of the wise and foolish builders.
Oh, my God, yes.
The wise builder who built his house on the rock and the fool who built it on the sand. And I definitely stand on the side of the fool. I'm out here on the sand and hoping that I don't get washed away. But in the meantime, enjoying myself.
No, you know, I mean, it's wild. We live in a coastal town, but we're not on a barrier island, and we deliberately bought well for us, which would be a good thing, not for you. We bought well east of the high water line, the coastal construction. Anyway, I don't want to bring everybody down because this is a great book on a rising swell. We're putting a link not only to how to buy it in the show notes, but a great little post about it on the UPF website. Thank you for writing it. I honestly can say I never expected to be enjoying a book about surfing as much as I'm enjoying yours. So I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to what you write next. Do you have another book in you?
Yes, definitely. And thank you guys so much for having me on. That's what I tried to do to make it so that if you were a total kook, you could open this book and read it. And by the end, you would know a little bit more and you would have a good time. You know, it's like your first surf session. I'm not trying to make it you know, surf insider jargony or anything like that. So
no, it kind of makes me want to be in better shape so I could learn to surf, but it's, you know.
And I'm kicking myself for not buying it. I was at an event where they had your book and I could have bought it at my author's discount. And they were talking you up, which is cool. So your next event, I mean, this will probably not go live until after your Cocoa Beach talk has happened, but is in Daytona, June 13th and 14th?
Oh, yeah. If June 13th and 14th, they do something called the Florida Surf Film Festival, which happens twice a year. And it's a really big, nice event. And people come from all over, from California and Hawaii, and famous surfers. And they do these really good films out there. And so I'm just going to be there. I'm going to have a small booth and I'll be have some books and hope to see anybody out there who wants to come in. It's more of a party. It's pretty fun. It's a good place to go. And I'd like to meet you guys. Yeah.
Where in Daytona?
I love Cocoa.
Yeah, where in Daytona is it going to be?
It's, I think, the Atlantic Center for the Arts.
Cool. Oh, I love the ACA. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That sounds amazing.
So, yeah, that'll be fun.
Do they ever do it in Cocoa?
That particular surf film festival, they used to do it in St. Augustine. Now they've moved to Daytona, and that's where they're headquartered.
Fair enough. Daytona's nice too. I'm a big Cocoa fan. So,
well, we have the Surfside Playhouse here on Cocoa Beach, and that's what we're doing for the Florida Surf Museum movie event, which is more localized. It's a lot smaller and it's more homegrown.
Oddly enough, you have a Thai restaurant. I mean, there's no shortage of Thai restaurants, but there's a Thai restaurant in Cocoa I've loved for years, and I don't know why. I don't think it's any better than any other Thai restaurant, but it's one of my favorite places.
Which one?
It's across from, I think it used to be called International Palms. Is it called Siam?
Siam Orchid?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, nice.
You have others that are better, but...
Well, we have... when I first moved here 20 years ago, we had a dearth of good dining options, because Bernard's, which serviced the astronauts of the Mercury and Apollo mission, it was just closing down, and that was a classic. And we had some other ones that shut down, and we had, you know, a few years there where we were you know, in a food desert. But now we have so many good options. Cocoa Beach has, I would say, the best dining options this side of Orlando. It's really nice over here. So we've got
My brother lives over in Melbourne, and he spends a lot of time at the O'Galley Arts District. And I went down there, I guess it was last year, and was really impressed with the scene. It seemed pretty
beautiful.
Cool.
Yeah, it's beautiful out there for sure.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot going on the Space Coast.
Bart County.
We should have you on just to hit the highlights of things to do there.
I'll come on anytime, guys. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Seriously, call me anytime. I love talking Florida, and this is great.
You know, maybe we could talk about beach renourishment the next time it comes up. So.
We forgot enough of that ranting and raving.
I know, but it's just so nice. Like-minded people. All right. Check out Dan's book. It's a fun read. It's a quick read. All right. Well, hey, go surf. I know that's what you want to be doing.
All right.
And
thank you so much.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming
on. As always, we want to thank our active paid supporters who help make our podcasting and coffee habit possible. You too can get your name read off at the end of every episode. And it doesn't have to be your real name. It can be anything. It could be Ryan loves Florida or Ryan hates Governor DeSantis. I'm just tracking off something that one of our listeners has been pretty clear about. Anyway, we want to thank our active supporters, Stephanie Hewley, Brad Sager, Brian Woodall, The Betts Boys Adventure, Elise Smith, Carol Miller, Leslie Hallweg, Davita Breyer, Natalie Zachrick, Angela Connolly, John Bown, Ryan Worthington, and Michael Gargalak. And that's it for this time, folks. We'll see you next week.
Bye.